Det var jo de årene da han hadde nok så sterke indre brytninger. Indre brytninger.
Hei og velkommen til Noen har snakket sammen. Mitt navn Tiril Rustad Halvorsen.
Og jeg heter Aksel Fjellovli. Mm. Denne uka her så skal vi ta for oss et av de virkelig store temaene, nemlig demokratiet vårt.
Selv om vi jo har snakket om demokratiet de siste episodene, med litt den der sånn konkret praktisk utfall av den.
Ja, vi snakker jo om demokrati stadig vekk, men her det litt mer på et fundamentalt nivå.
Ja,
okay. Med liksom spørsmål som... vi demokratisk nok, egentlig? Vi slapp jo et nytt notat fra Agenda denne uka her, som viser at selv om vi jo har lik rett til å delta i demokratiet gjennom å stemme ved valg, så det betydelige forskjeller både i deltagelse og i tillit til politikere og storting. Og det ganske systematisk hvordan de her forskjellene ser ut. De som tjener mindre, de som har praktiske yrker, de som unge, de som bor i distriktene, for eksempel, har både mindre tillit og, til politikere, til Stortinget, og de deltar også mindre i demokratiet.
Mm. Men det likevel ikke grunn til noen alarmisme på vegne av demokratiet i Norge. Det jo et av de demokratiene som står stødigst og har høyest oppslutning i verden. Men kanskje nettopp derfor, da, fordi vi ser jo tilbakeslag i land som Polen og Ungarn og Tyrkia, og sist også kanskje stormingen av kongressbygningen i USA, gjør at vi har litt sånn overskudd, da, demokratisk overskudd, til å snakke om det. Vi har fortsatt overblikk og ja, kapasitet.
Mm. Absolutt. Og den vi har med oss som gjest denne uka her, Ellen Landemore, som professor i statsvitenskap ved Yale University i USA. Og hun har nettopp holdt det som årets aula-foredrag i universitetets aula i Oslo i regi av UiOda og Tankesmien Agenda. Hun dessuten aktuell med en ny bok som heter Open Democracy. Og hun opptatt av hvordan demokratiet kan reformeres med nye og åpne reformer for politisk innflytelse og makt, som for eksempel bruk av lotteri, borgerforsamlinger og folkeavstemninger. Helene Landemore sitter I studio med oss nå. So, Professor Landemore, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So we have seen several examples of democracies in crisis the last couple of years, undermining of institutions by populist leaders, and that may be one of the most discussed aspects the last couple of years. But you say that we can't understand a crisis of democracy just as hiccups of a well-functioning system, but rather sort of that there are some intrinsic flaws to our model of representative government, that we got it wrong even from the sketchboard when our democratic systems were designed. So could you please elaborate this a feature, not a bug, critique of yours?
Yes. So first of all, notice that you said we've seen our democracies undermined by populist leaders, right? That's an assumption about causality, which I think is wrong. I mean, it's not completely wrong, but it's this idea that it's because of populist leaders that we're in trouble. If only we could get rid of, you know, Trump and Bolsonaro and people like that, everything would be well under the sun. And I don't think that's true. I think the populist leaders are, yes, they are undermining democracy to a degree, but they're largely a symptom of a much deeper problem.
And what is that?
Elitism. The fact that our systems are not sufficiently democratic and, in fact, are profoundly oligarchic. Mm. And that's a feature, not a bug. If you look back at the history of those regimes and how they were created and along what sort of ideological principles, they were born in the 18th century as a way to established rule by a natural aristocracy of sorts with the popular consent of the masses. But we know from Aristotle, you know, to contemporary political scientists, really, that elections are an oligarchic way of distributing political office. When you distribute political office, political power through elections, what happens? You end up with a concentration of power in the hands of a relatively relatively homogeneous socioeconomic group of people who may have the best intentions, but are not truly representative in a statical sense of the larger population. And you might say, well, that's a good thing. You know, we get the best and brightest in power. And I question that. I think that actually, if we want to have a smart government, and in particular assemblies where laws and policies are produced that are actually good at governance and producing laws and policies that satisfy most people, you need to have a lot more diversity and you need to have a lot more inclusion. And that can be done by organizing our system so that they are truly democratically representative, not oligarchically so, if you will. Mm. Does that make sense?
Indeed. I just wonder, when you discuss democratic or the word democratic, one such minimum definition used by some would be that there is a peaceful change of guards through elections over time. That could be one way to measure it. But you have a sort of deeper understanding of what to be democratic is. So how would you define it? In what directions are we to move?
Right, but do you realize that a change of guard, I mean, if we're just switching between oligarchs, how is that democratic? I know we've come to mean that over the years, and it's very important that we have that choice. I'm not saying it's not a massive improvement over authoritarian regimes or monarchies from yesteryear, but if we take the word democracy seriously, it's about people power. And there's very little power in choosing. I mean, there is power, but it's limited in choosing your ruler. The real power is in exercising power, in having it in your own hands. And that's very different. That's a very different. If you start with that assumption and that definition, you will be naturally led to a much more ambitious and radical design.
Mm-hmm. And we also know that there are some people today that are not using their existing power to elect their representatives, even though they are elites. And what do we know about which people are not being heard or not using their electoral votes today?
Great question. And I think the reason why they are not exercising their right to vote is partly because they are disillusioned with the system and they feel like even if they did use that power, it would mean very little. They would have very little impact on policy and laws. Consider the US case. Right, their political scientists have demonstrated that the causal impact of majorities on policy and lawmaking processes is null, quasi-null, right? Because what really determines public policies and laws in the US are the preferences of the 10 richest percent of the population. So it's ruled by economic elites there. What does that leave out? Well, everyone else. 90% of the population to some degree, right? They when they get what they want, it's by coincidence, when they happen to want the same thing that economic elites want. How is that democratic? Mm. We know in France that the people who don't feel represented and who don't vote are the people who recently broke on the public stage by putting on these yellow vests, you know, that we have to have by law in our cars. They put on those yellow vests because they wanted to be visible in a system where they're not visible, they're not in parliaments and places of power. And they also wanted to be heard. They wanted to be given a voice, which they don't think the electoral system gives them. And I think they're correct. I'm not saying there are solutions or there are methods of, you know, trying to solve the issue are necessarily the right ones, but the diagnostic seems to me correct. The youth as well is very much underrepresented. At least in the US and in France. I am less confident about Norway, but this is another underserved, underrepresented, underheard constituency.
Yeah, there is indeed a skew in participation towards older people and also representation towards more middle-aged people in the Norwegian system. But I'm just thinking, when you're saying you're criticizing not only how it's working, but how it is on a more fundamental level. And then you start to think, what is the alternative to that? And most people would say, okay, people's power, that would remind them of ancient Greece, maybe, people coming to the agora to discuss, and this is direct democracy, and as opposed to a more indirect representative system that we have now. But you are arguing that your conception of solutions, it's not actually direct democracy, but rather something you call open democracy. What is the distinction here, going forward from the representative system?
So it's not direct democracy, because for me, direct democracy would mean, open assemblies, including everyone all the time, and mass voting all the time on every decision. I suppose that's what many people mean by direct democracy. And I do think that this is not doable or even desirable, because we don't all have time to be in meetings all day long, and it's not very efficient, and you cannot conduct the kind of thoughtful deliberation you need, at the large scale. At least we still don't know how to do that. So instead, what I want is a system where we do have representation, so a division of labor between the rulers and the ruled, but any one of us could be in that position at one point in our life. And at every point of the process, you can still contribute through the use of your participation rights. So how do you make it so that people can represent and be represented in turn? You introduce selection by lot, the concept of civic lotteries, right? Where it's like jury duty. You give people a right to be chosen by lot. So it's one person, one lottery ticket. And then when their number comes up, they are strongly encouraged to go and take on those duties and responsibilities of lawmakers, basically, by joining a house of the people that's a permanent institution, and in which they stay maybe a couple of months, maybe a couple of years. Not entirely sure about the details, but the idea would be that democratic representation is still there, but not in an electoral form, but in a lotocratic form, if you will, based on lot. And when I say that people should still have the right throughout the process to contribute, even if their number didn't come up, I mean that they should be empowered to put things on the agenda of that assembly through the Citizens Initiative, for example. The Citizens Initiative is the right of citizens to come up with an idea, put it up on a website, gather signatures for it, and if they meet the threshold of signatures, then by default their proposal goes to a debate in parliament, or perhaps even to a referendum if it's in legal format. Similarly, they can retain their rights throughout to recall an elected official or a lotocratic official that they think is not doing their job correctly, or they can recall a law or a policy that's not working if they again gather enough signatures and perhaps get the decision approved in a referendum. Mm-hmm. So it's basically a very different vision. It's taking the best of ancient practice. Ancient practices, and the best of recent innovations in participatory democracy.
And there have been examples, and they are functioning, as you write about in your book, in particularly France and in Ireland. And can you tell us more about what they have done there and how it's working?
Right. So there indeed have been a number of experimentations and processes that involve randomly selected citizens in particular. A recent report by the OECD documents more than 400 such mini publics over the last 20 years. So we're not talking about something that's completely utopian or hasn't been tried yet. It's been tried. And the salient cases have been, as you said, the Irish assemblies, so and more recently the French Convention for Climate. So I'll talk briefly about it. In Ireland, in 2012, they decided that they needed to have a conversation about marriage equality and decide whether this was, a possibility. So they convened a hybrid assembly of 66 randomly selected citizens and 33 politicians, plus a chair. And they got that hybrid assembly to deliberate and make a recommendation that was then put to a referendum, which was to legalize marriage for homosexuals. And then this was put to a referendum and it passed. It was such a success that a few years later, when the island faced another sort of conundrum, which was whether or not to decriminalize abortion, they decided to do it with a purely randomly selected assembly of 99 citizens. That assembly, you know, consulted experts, listened to stories of women who had faced difficult pregnancies and things like that. And they came up with the conclusion, even in this very Catholic country, that they had to allow for a right to abortion. And so they again put up a recommendation, the parliament put it to a referendum, and it passed in June 2018. So over there, it worked so well that they recently did another assembly on climate change and climate justice, so it's really working quite well. In France, inspired by the Irish example, Macron convened an assembly of 150 randomly selected citizens to address issues around climate change and climate justice, in part because he had failed earlier to pass a carbon tax that had triggered this yellow vest movement. So over the course of a year, roughly, those 150 citizens deliberated and came up with proposals about how to curb greenhouse gas emissions by 40% of the 1990s level in a spirit of social justice. And it's been less of a success, perhaps, than the Irish example, because only 10 to 15% of the proposals have been passed by Parliament. But what's really striking for me is that it was more ambitious than any design I'm aware of, because it was not just like a general task of agenda setting or emitting a general recommendation about whether or not to allow for a certain policy to be passed, like in Ireland. It was truly about generating quasi-bills, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was literally putting the citizens in a position of lawmakers, which I think was very mm-hmm. ambitious.
Maybe it's obvious, but I was wondering if you could spell out to us maybe what these assemblies have or what they do better than the elected officials in Parliament, because it's representatives both. So what's the difference?
So the difference is that people come in those assemblies not on the basis of how much charisma they have, how many connections they have, how much wealth they have, what party they belong to, what ideas they support. They come in those assemblies just because they are citizens. And so it's truly expressive of the principle of political equality in a way. But second of all, they also have something that I think elected assemblies lack, which is a diversity of perspectives and information brought by the larger sort of spectrum of the population that it represents, right? You in the French Convention for Climate, you had two homeless persons that, not sure they attended all of the sessions, but at least at the beginning they were there. I think it's very important to have people like that, because when you're going to make laws on the fate of the homeless, for example, and you have to look into the eyes of one as you make proposals and then you vote, I think it's very different than when you're making those decisions when those people are absent. Mm. And it's true of any other category. You know, it's important that the people who are going to be affected by those decisions are somehow represented in the room.
Mm. So the idea is that more representation makes better lawmaking or outcomes
yes.
than, let's say, more experience.
Well, there's a trade-off there. Mm-hmm. I'm not denying that there's a trade-off between individual competence, which might be improved over years of practice of politics as a job, for sure. But there's another dimension of what I call collective intelligence, which is the diversity of the group. And I think in this trade-off, I tend to think that we're better off maximizing cognitive diversity over individual competence in that sense. Mm. And in fact, too much individual competence in the sense of pure professionalization can backfire. Because when politicians have been in power for 25 years, they become a caste of their own, with their own corporate interests, their own biased view of what the country is about. It's not that necessarily intentional. I'm not accusing them of corruption or anything like that, but they start having blind spots and be out of touch. Mm. And I think that the big populist resentment against elected officials, it's about that, essentially. It's you're out of touch, you're disconnected. You don't understand us and you don't represent us as a result.
I just see there maybe in every kind of setup of a democratic system, there would be a fundamental tension between representation on the one hand and deliberation on the other hand. I don't know if you agree to that description, but when you deliberate, the ideal form, the best ideas would win. But on the other hand, in a system with a lot of representation, people would be backed by other people in either through voting or through being from the same group or any kind of representational link. But that representational link may make it harder to deliberate freely. Do you agree that that trade-off is there?
So when you say that representative link, you mean electoral link?
Not necessarily, because in your book, Open Democracy, you also write of representation as a link between people of some kinds and other people of the same kind.
Yes, I see what you mean. So you mean even a randomly selected assembly would have that. Well, yes, I know. I mean, when you're young in an assembly that's randomly selected, you may feel that you represent the youth and you have a duty to speak on their behalf. Does that mean that you're not free to pursue, a conversation and change your mind? Absolutely not. In a deliberative space, you should have that freedom. It's not a mandate. You haven't been mandated by anyone. So if you feel like you need to represent the youth, it's on you. It's your choice. It's your, you know. So it's so the concept of representation I have in mind is not something that's an electoral sort of leash or even a self-imposed constraint because you belong to a certain demographic. In fact, what I actually do not like essentializing people either by their gender, their age, their ethnicity or anything like that. So I do think that, you know, when I talk about random selection, you do need to have some criteria that you make sure are present. So gender, geographic origin, education level, and all that, because the samples are usually too small to rely on pure random selection alone to get a statistically representative sample. But what I don't want for the people who are in these assemblies to do is to think that, oh, I'm, you know, an older white guy, therefore I represent the older white guy. No, you're there to make the best use of your cognitive, you know, faculties and your emotional faculties, and you bring that to the service of the group. And you just trust that, yes, it's going to be colored by your experience and your gender and your history and your geography. But it's not a destiny. It's you know, you should be free to use that in the service of truth and ideas and the common good.
But I mean, in a political system like the Norwegian one, and in many Western political systems, you have this two-sidedness of parties. On the one hand, it's sort of a marketplace of parties for voters to choose from freely. But on the other hand, they have roots in different interests in society. That may be labor unions, business interests, churches, green NGOs, also different kinds of links, representational links to groups. When you are talking about mini-publics, these kinds of randomly selected assemblies, you sort of strengthen deliberation, maybe because people are more free to discuss, but don't you weaken this link to different groups in society?
Yes. Well, yes and no. It's going to be a deliberation among individuals, not representative of unions or representative of parties or representative interest groups of any kind. It's between individuals, qua citizens. And frankly, I think democracy should be about that. We don't want a democracy of unions or a democracy of associations or a democracy of parties. It's about individuals. Does that mean those people have no roots, are not influenced by their various identities? No, but these identities or these interest groups and associations they may be affiliated with can only intervene, at the periphery of the assembly. They can be invited to give guest lecture. They can try to influence the deliberation inside the convention, but at the end of the day, they are in the service of that deliberation, not in a position to control it. So one question you might have is like, well, but isn't democracy not just about figuring out the truth or the common good, but truly it's about arbitrating between conflicting interests? And how would that be done in the context of a mini public? Well, so I've seen, for example, in the Citizens Convention for Climate, you know, renters argue with property owners on the question of whether mandatory housing renovation was fair, right? Because it puts a lot of burden on owners to the benefit of renters, because they're not the ones that are going to, you know, pay the retrofitting for energy, you know, purposes. But they talked and talked and talked, and they came to some conclusions about, you know, well, under what circumstances can owners get some financial help from the state, under what conditions, you know, renters may be able to chip in, or, you know, like there was all these intricate conversations about how to make that fair. So I think many of the conflicts we see as irreducible can actually be worked out in a deliberative context. So they become from a negative sum game where, you know, if you lose, if you win, I lose, and vice versa. They can be turned into positive sum game where, well, we all benefit from curbing our greenhouse gas emissions. So how do we distribute the burden here in a way that in the end is a net positive for everyone? That said, you might say, well, sure, but at the end of the day, there are still profound value conflicts that will not be solved that way. And maybe indeed at that point, either you say, well, we take a vote, it's a majority, you know, decisions, or you say, well, it's a work of a different chamber, a chamber where organized civil society is represented, and you have union representatives, party representatives. These are
so you mean like in the US or the French system where you have different chambers of...
Yes. For example, maybe it's a hybrid system is the solution here, but I'm not sure. I think that potentially you could have a purer form of open democracy in the sense that I have in mind, where the center is this mini public, if you will, that's open to the rest of the country. And all these associations are floating around it, informing it, trying to influence it, forming, you know, parties around referenda that are organized on specific issues. And so they still have a role to play, but it's just that they won't be the decision makers. Mm-hmm.
Is the goal with these assemblies to find unity and to agree on everything? Or because you're right about more majoritarian rule. Also,
well, so I think it's got to be both, right? I mean, the idea is that you take deliberation as far as it can take the group, so that you get the renters and the owners to at least, you know, reach some vision where everybody can be satisfied. And then at the point at which you can no longer go further, you start taking a vote. You know, it's deliberation plus majority rule. It's how we solve disagreements in many contexts. And then you learn to live with the results, even if you're in the minority. What's interesting, though, is that in the French context, for example, of the Citizens' Convention, when they reached their 149 proposals, there was a huge consensus behind each of them, except one. I think the when they voted on their proposals, the margin of, you know, approval was always somewhere along like 80%, 90% of votes in favor of the proposal. Except one, as I said, which was lowering the speed limit on highways to 110 kilometers per hour. That didn't get a lot of support, so they only passed it with 67% or something like that of the votes. And unsurprisingly, you know, this wasn't really supported massively in the larger population. People like to be able to speed on the highway. So I'm just saying that, you know, we're not aiming for winning by just one vote. The idea is that if you deliberate and convince each other and create a sense of community, you will get a lot of support behind the proposals. Mm. But at some point, yes, we have to stop the conversation and get to a decision, and voting is where you do that. Mm.
I just want to ask about capture of these kind of assemblies. So by capture, I mean that those representatives or members of an assembly, that they are what they are discussing and what are the outcomes of the discussions, that is actually decided by someone else, then the assembly is captured. You could imagine several types. You could have sort of elite capture from the outside, or you could have like expert capture, where bureaucracies actually decide what to do. You could have interest group capture from the outside. How do you, because these people in these assemblies would, I would assume, would be ordinary people sitting there for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. What muscles do they have to avoid capture? Not what competence really, but what muscles do they have to avoid it when they are rotating?
Right. So that's where institutional design really matters, because of course you're right, no system is foolproof, and capture is a problem for these assemblies, just as it is a problem by for elected assemblies. In fact, elected assemblies are very vulnerable to capture by lobbyists and interest groups, because they depend on the campaign donations of, you know, at least in the US, of economic groups. So it's not surprising to see that, you know, if you need to raise millions of dollars to be elected, that then you, surprise, surprise, end up being very pro, you know, industry and against workers, because only one constituency really supports your livelihood, right? So what's the problem with mini publics? These are really novice people. They're rotated frequently. They could easily be captured. I think they're less likely to be captured by lobbyists, precisely because lobbyists would have to invest so much energy in corrupting one randomly selected citizen, yet and then another one, and then another one in retail fashion, and then next thing you know, they're out of power, and you have to start all over again. So actually, the rotation is actually helping here. But what's more of a danger, in my view, is captured by the bureaucrats and the civil servants that are around and in the service, supposedly, of these assemblies, because they are the permanent furniture of the republic. And they can just decide to ignore what the, you know, randomly selected citizens want, and sort of subtly control the agenda, deform the intentions. I mean, yes, it can happen, definitely. I think that you combat that through several things. You create firewalls that make sure that, you know, there's no unethical relations between civil servants and the citizens. You make sure to instill in your civil servant an ethos of service as opposed to domination. So that means socializing them to being on tap and not on top, you know, in this process, at the service of citizens, not in a position of lecturing at them or in a position of telling them what to do or manipulating them. All of that should be curbed, and you can use ethics committees, for example, to make sure, you know, bad things don't happen, and you empower citizens so that they can appeal to the relevant institution in case of breaches of this implicit contract, stuff like that. And I'll tell you something which is really came out of the observation of the Citizens Convention for Climate. If you give people power, they will use it. And so when citizens were empowered in this setting to make quasi-laws, really, oh, they seized the opportunity, and they were very jealous of that power and that prerogative. And they didn't like it when experts told them what to do. So experts came and testified and said, oh, you know, climate change, carbon tax is the solution. They said that over and over again. The citizens wouldn't have it. They just didn't want to do that for many reasons. So obviously they could push back against even very consensual expert advice. Similarly, when experts told them, well, you know, you have to respect the 3% deficit rule, you know, of the Maastricht treaties, and if it costs too much, it won't be implemented. The experts tried to like give them a sort of normative framework of austerity, and they just didn't like it either. They said, well, let us figure out how we finance this. Of course, the budget is a constraint, but it's not for you to tell us, right? And to preemptively put a limitation on what can be said. So I think that, yes, you're right, capture is going to be an issue. But if you think smartly about the design and you create the right incentives, it can be vastly limited.
Mm. How do you avoid that these assemblies make hollow decisions that nobody follows? I guess different real-life examples have different mandates and therefore also different levels of success. And I guess it's It's kind of like a trend to listen to all kinds of interest groups nowadays. How do you avoid that? That's just some, I think you maybe called it decision washing or something in your talk.
Participation washing. Yeah. How do you avoid participation washing and you make sure these assemblies have a real impact? Well, in the ideal, you'd give them real power, meaning you'd, you know, engage in a constitutional reform whereby you create a house of the people with like constitutional powers to legislate on certain issues. That's
so you write them into the constitution.
You write it in the constitution and you give them a status that's on a par with that of an elected assembly. Of course, we're not there yet. So how do you make sure there's an impact absent this kind of constitutional buttressing? Well, ideally, again, you'd have politicians in a position of power that would support and pre-commit to whatever outcome comes out of these assemblies. In a way, that's what President Macron in France had done. He really raised the profile of the assembly because at the very beginning he said, look, I'm serious about this. You know, if you give me really good proposals, I'll submit them without filtering, these were his words, to either direct regulation, a referendum, or a parliamentary debate. And I'm sure, I mean, I hope he was sincere when he said that. I think it was very important to motivate the citizens, to give visibility to the assembly and all that. But the fact is, at the end of the process, he started by vetoing three of the proposals. Mm-hmm. And then when the proposals went through the you know, regulatory process and the parliamentary debate, they ended up being quite hollowed out of content. And very few of them were actually implemented as recommended by the citizens. So It's a battle. I don't know. I think you need pressure from social movements. You need a lot of circumstances that you know, stars need to be aligned for that to happen. And I'm not entirely sure what the secret recipe is, but you need support from insiders. And so it's better to try to go at it in a conciliatory way rather than in a sort of purist way where you want nothing to do with elected powers from the get-go. You need to get some elected officials on board for this to work.
Professor Landemo, I see our time is soon running out here. I just wanted to ask you one final question about the specific Norwegian situation, because your ideas can be sort of implemented as radical society-wide change on a big scale. But I wondered if we take a look at some specific Norwegian problems, which is, I guess, quite common to Western democracies, that participation is skewed, where people from with lower incomes, lower education, younger people, people in rural areas, participate less in democracy and also have less trust in politicians and democratic institutions. If we are to start doing some innovations to curb those problems, how could we start to do that?
Well, you could start copying what's being done in Belgium and is soon going to be done in Paris at the municipal level. It's at the municipal level in Paris, it's at the regional level in East Belgium. So in East Belgium, it's a German-speaking region of Belgium, they created a council of 27 randomly selected citizens to set the agenda for the local parliament. So it's the first permanent institutionalized mini public that I know of, right? It was in place for an entire year and it gave directions to the parliament. It had the possibility to convene other citizens' assemblies on specific topics. In Paris, they just voted to create a citizen body of 100 Parisians selected at random to similarly influence city politics. And so I think you could start there. It's very concrete, very local. It would speak to people and show the usefulness of this form of democratic representation, I think.
Helene Landemo, thank you very much for joining our podcast.
Ja, det var Helene Landemo. Det foredraget hun holdt i Aurland tidligere i dag, det blir etter hvert lagt ut på Tankesmien Agenda sin podcast.
Som en lydfil.
Feed, som en lydfil. Mm. For de som mer interessert, eller så sikkert boka har fått tak i.
Mm.
Men vi har vel noen anbefalinger utenom det også, vi Aksel?
Ja da, jeg tenker litt sånn, det er jo skrevet mye om demokrati de siste årene, særlig etter valget av Donald Trump. Det er jo en hel håper å si, hylle i en vanlig arkbokhandel om demokrati snart. Jeg leste en av de bøkene som man finner i en sånn hyllepark i sommer. Den heter Twilight of Democracy, The Failure of Politics and the Parting of Friends, av en som heter Anne Applebaum. Det handler mye om Polen og Ungarn og situasjonen der spesielt, og hun, hvis jeg ikke husker feil, er jo også gift med en tidligere polsk minister, og skrive om hvordan på en måte mange i Polen kom ut av hele den her Solidarność, dette ut av Østblokk-øyeblikket, som en sånn, nå går vi mot demokratiets lys, men så har man endt opp med ganske antidemokratiske politiske resultater likevel, og diskutere blant annet hvordan elitene har spilt en rolle i det da, i blant annet Polen.
Kanskje Polen må hente en og annen idé fra Landemore.
Kanskje det.
Jeg tenkte å anbefale en økonomifestival, Kokonomics, som foregår i Stavanger neste uke, fra onsdag til og med lørdag. Masse tett og tett med gode programmer, med gode møter om diverse økonomiske spørsmål. Helt sikkert også økonomisk demokrati. Så hvis du i Stavanger, eller har anledning til å reise dit, anbefales sterkt. Du kan også møte flere fra Agenda der, faktisk.
Ja, så det.
Ja. Nei, men fint. Da snakkes vi igjen neste uke.
Det er vi. Hei då.